Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. It's always fun on a Friday when you hear that music. That means Jimmy Akin's here, and we're giving him some weird questions to answer. Lots of great weird questions so far. Jimmy's in studio because it is, as we've been mentioning throughout the week, it is propinquity week here at Catholic Answers. That is, it's like high school homecoming. That's what it is. Everybody came back around, and some... I think one person has never been here. New employee, Melanie.
Yeah.
I think she's this is her first time here.
So only, it's nice to see everybody. I'm not here anymore.
Wait, you are now.
I know. It's getting weirder because I'm here to begin with, and that's weird. But now it gets weirder because I'm not here anymore because we pre-recorded
this. Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, yeah. So Jimmy's actually... As you're hearing this, Jimmy is not here anymore.
Either at home or close to being home.
Yeah, yeah. Depending on how many dust storms you hit on the way. Hopefully zero. All right, back to the weirdness that was sent to us. This comes from Virginia Charlotte 7007. Could the extreme ages of people in the genealogies of the Bible refer to the length years of one man's successive generations in real time, rather than the single person's actual age at death? How are these extreme ages of people in the Bible to be understood?
So if I understand Virginia Charlotte correct, she's proposing, and if I don't understand her, my apologies, she can write back and let me know. But if I understand her question correctly, she's proposing a theory that has been proposed by some individuals seeking to explain the phenomenally long ages attributed to some of the patriarchs. And that theory holds that they're not the, despite what you might think on first reading, they're not meant to be the lifespans of single individuals. They're meant to be the lifespans of multiple generations in someone's family. And the way this is normally phrased is in terms of clans. So you've got this founder of a clan, and then that clan remains in dominance for a significant period of time.
Oh, yeah.
And then a new clan, perhaps descended from someone in the first clan, gets founded and is dominant for a period of time. So this is a clan-based explanation rather than an individual-based explanation of these lifespans. And it's an interesting proposal. My initial reaction to it is to be very skeptical.
Okay.
I would want to see this documented. And I know individuals, not personally, but I know individuals who proposed this, and I haven't seen it argued in detail. I would want to see it argued in detail, and I would want to see it deal with various objections. So, you know, there's in terms more broadly, though, of how do we understand these ages, there is no church teaching on it. So the church does not have any doctrine says you should take them this way or you should take them that way. So it's all speculation. And so
Okay. Various
speculations are okay. One of the problems that I would pose for the clan theory is why there's such an orderly succession of clans. Because they're presented as this guy begets this guy begets this guy. And why isn't it one long clan then? You know, now I can imagine ways to answer that, but I would want to see those answers argued for. And because the way it's presented is as a normal genealogy where all the people are related to each other in a lineal fashion, that you would think they'd all be part of the same clan. Another problem is there's a another problem is the way they're phrased, because it will say in like Genesis 5 and Genesis 10, these are the major sections where these genealogies come up. It'll say like Adam lived X years and became the father of Y, and then he lived Z years, and the total years of his life were, you know, Y plus Z, Y, X plus Y, or whatever. And so why is the next clan being fathered so early, and then the there's all the rest of this time in there? And so that's another problem I'd have. Then there's the big exception in the genealogy in Genesis 5, which is Enoch. Enoch has a dramatically different lifespan. His is 365 years. And that is interpreted by later biblical writers and extra-biblical writers as being 365 years for one individual, not a clan. Now, maybe all them are wrong, but then how do we explain what's said in this text in terms of this clan-based model? You know, why did the Enoch clan die out so quick? Why was it taken by God in a way different than all these other clans? And then there's the obvious symbolism of the number 365, which is the number of days in a solar year. And if you look at carefully at the numbers that are recorded for other patriarchs, there seem to be, at least it's been proposed, that there are numerical patterns in them too that have to deal with astronomy. Specifically, that the patterns tend to be based on what's called the synodic period, which is a synodic period is the time it takes for a planet to return to the same position in the sky relative to the sun. And it looks like some of these other patriarchs, their ages may not be based on the solar year the way Enoch's life is. They may be based on these synodic periods. And so that would suggest these numbers have a symbolic value rather than being literally this clan was in prominence for this long. Then you've got to deal with the fact that the lifespans shorten over time. Because they start, you know, like 800-900 years long, and then they once you get after the flood, they really start dropping down to more contemporary values. So it looks like, why would the clans have shifted like this, and how would you even have knowledge of these pre-flood clans in such detail? So it seems to me that like it, the clan idea is an interesting proposal. But it seems to me there are a bunch of difficulties with it that I haven't seen answered. I'd like to see it argued both for and against in detail. I haven't seen that yet, but it's something I'll continue to research. The way it looks to me, my opinion of how we're the best way to understand these ages, is that they are symbolic of the greatness of the ancestors. Because we have parallel texts from other ancient Near Eastern civilizations that attribute super long lifespans to patriarchal figures as a way of showing how great they were. And so I think that's the same thing going on here. It's like the Israelites are saying, hey, our ancestors, they're no small potatoes either. And the specific ages that are attributed to them are based on various numerical calculations, some of which may involve astronomy, but there's a clear shift in how they work because there's this blending from these ancient lifespans to modern lifespans that takes place, and that means you can't just apply the same method throughout. You've got to bridge the two different systems of calculation.
Virginia Charlotte, thank you very much for the question. That'll take us to our first break for this hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Weird Questions for Jimmy continues right after this.
Your questions, Catholic answers, live.
Support for Catholic Answers Live comes from Catholic Chemistry, a dating app for Catholics. Founded by a longtime member of the Catholic Answers team, CatholicChemistry.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN offers listeners and viewers the daily readings to enable you to accompany the Mass of the day. Our Catholic daily readings include the readings of the day, along with online videos. It's a great resource for all who desire to live a life of faith that is pleasing to our Lord. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
That is some weird questions music right there, and we've got weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. Jimmy tackles all kinds of questions at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, questions having to do with mysteries of the faith over at the Jimmy Akin podcast. And each Monday you get a new – Jimmy has the week covered. You can start Monday with a Jimmy Akin podcast, and you can end on a Friday with with a Mysterious World podcast, so
and with Catholic Answers Live.
Oh, that's right, and then this, of course.
I also have another podcast that comes out on Mondays, typically, which is Secrets of Star Trek.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. At the Star Quest.
Yeah. And we did have Doctor Who going, but we ran out of Doctor Who episodes.
That kind of amazes me.
After 60 years.
Wow. I've never heard anyone say we ran out of Doctor Who episodes. That's not a problem most people face. That's impressive, Jimmy. So now you're doing Star Trek.
I have been doing Star Trek all this time. Yeah. It's just we haven't run out of Star Trek episodes yet.
All right, so what dropped last Monday? What do we look forward to next Monday on the Jimmy Akin podcast?
Okay, so this last Monday, I have started... mentioning in different Jimmy Akin podcasts, I do ideas for other shows, you know, other episodes. Like if you'd like me to do an episode on this, let me know in the comments. If you'd like me to do an episode on that, let me know in the comments. And the reason I do that is because I can't talk about everything in one episode. Mm-hmm. So I need to compartmentalize it. And then it's a kind of market research to find out, would people like this?
Yeah.
And I got – so recently I said if you'd like me to do an episode on like when or how the books of Moses were written, let me know. And a lot of people responded to that. So that's what this week's episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast that's already out is about. It's about the five books of Moses and how they were written, who wrote them, when they were written. We can't pin everything down, but I cover the major theories. There's the Moses theory, that Moses wrote them all. There's the what's known as the documentary hypothesis. Some people call it the Wellhausen hypothesis or the JEDP theory. I talk about that. And then there's an intermediate hypothesis that is kind of between the two that I also talk about. And even though I don't think we can pin down specific dates, not the way we can for the Gospels, because I've already done when are the Gospels to be dated.
Right.
But we can, I think our way through these different theories. And so I end up telling you what some of the arguments are regarding each theory and which one I favor. So that was this last Monday. Coming up this next Monday, I have an interaction video. I guess some folks call them response videos, but I prefer calling them interaction videos because it's like I responded to this person. Sounds a little more confrontational than my own personal idiom.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I interact with this person.
Okay.
And Gavin Ortland, who is a Baptist pastor and apologist, recently released a video about relics in which he He says there's nothing in the Bible that's like the Catholic understanding of relics. And I thought that was a, during the course of this little 2-minute video, I thought, even though he's a very smart guy, I thought he was out of his depth in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have an almost hour-long video going through the evidence that he was apparently unaware of about what is in the Bible regarding relics and what we know, including from archaeology, about how ancient Israelites interacted with their dead. It's not as simple as you just bury the person and forget about them.
That may
happen in our culture.
Right.
But that's not how it worked in ancient Israel. And so coming up this Monday, I have almost an hour of interaction with Gavin's 2-minute video and all the things that it didn't include.
That's great. Very good. Check that out. Jimmy Akin podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcast, but you can also go to Jimmy's YouTube channel and find all of his stuff. I often have to ask you, what is the name referencing, Jimmy? Mm-hmm. Because people come up with these names that reference things on the internet or a show I haven't seen or something. But I know Boombatz. Our next guy is Boombatz 444.
Okay.
Because Dr. Vinnie Boombatz was Rodney Dangerfield's comedic doctor.
Uh-huh.
It was the bit was that Dr. Vinnie Boombatz was a terrible doctor. So his advice was terrible. And so
he's like Dr. Nick on The Simpsons. Hi, everybody.
Oh, I don't know, Doctor.
Oh,
but I don't really know
awesome.
The Simpsons. Is he?
He's awesomely bad.
Oh, is he? Yeah. So Dr. Vinnie Boombatz gave very bad advice to Rodney Dangerfield. And so Boombatz 444 asks this. I would like to know more about the Catholicism of the Michigan Melonheads.
Mm-hmm.
I heard they may be Catholic since they likely originated from a Catholic orphanage.
Okay, so this is not something that everybody in the U.S. is going to be familiar with. It's something that's particular to the state of Michigan, and basically the Michigan Melonheads are a bit of folklore about, they're from the Saugatuck, Allegan County area in western Michigan, and basically they are a group of small, the Melonheads are a group of small, feral, you know, meaning like not raised as, you know, wild children. You know, they're not raised normally. But they're described as a group of small, feral children with oversized, bulbous heads supposedly originated in child abuse or child experimentation in an asylum known as the Junction Insane Asylum near the Felt Mansion in this part of Michigan, and they were then released into the woods or escaped after mistreatment, sometimes said to have been performed by a mad doctor. And they lurk in the forests and attack people.
Wow.
Yeah. So those are some of the basic
and
claims.
No one's made a movie out of this yet. How have they missed this?
Yeah. Well, thus far I've described it as folklore, but now I'm going to use the more precise term for what it is. It's an urban legend.
Okay.
This is not a real group of people. The Allegan County Historical Society has done research into this, and they've confirmed that there was no such asylum or orphanage. So the basis of where these Melonhead kids came from just doesn't exist.
Okay.
And there was a prison later in the area, and there are lots of good, juicy urban legends connected with prisons. But there's nothing matching this prison with these horror elements. So
Okay. Basically,
this is it's just an urban legend. There are elements, though, that are real. There is a Catholic connection. So there was a family named the Felt, F-E-L-T family, which is a real name. I mean, I always thought of it as a cloth, but going back years, you know, I mean, maybe that's where the cloth got its name. I haven't looked that up. But going back years, you know, Deep Throat
was Mark Felt. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
right.
So it is an actual name. And there was a Felt mansion built in this part of Michigan in the 1920s.
Okay.
And it was by this wealthy family named Felt. And then in 1949, the mansion was purchased by the Augustinian order. And so that's the Catholic connection here.
Oh, okay.
And it became the St. Augustine Seminary, which was a boys' prep school and minor seminary. And because Catholics have a reputation for delivering quality education compared to some other outlets, the local public school kids started to refer to the, apparently started to refer to the attendees of the St. Augustine Seminary as melonheads, meaning they're like these super brainy types.
Yes.
And once they, and it was a, you know, way of mocking them and making fun of them. You know, these, oh, there's those Catholic seminary and schoolboys. They're so brainy, they got heads like a melon.
Right.
You know. And so that apparently is the origin of both the melon heads and the Catholic connection. And over time, folk processes worked on this, and it turned into this melon-headed horror story-inspired folktale.
It's just abuse of these Catholic, brilliant young Catholic minds referred to as melon heads. Kids are something. All right. Well, thank you for the question. Boombatz, and ask a question again because I want to bring up Dr. Vinny Boombatz again. This next one comes from Julian. Hi, Jimmy.
Nothing? Howdy.
No. I'm reading.
No, pause there. So you paused, yeah. So I figured I'd fill the dead air.
Thank you.
Been doing radio for 25 years. You get that impulse.
How much evidence is there for extraordinary charismatic gifts nowadays, and which is the strangest?
Well, in terms of which is the strangest, I don't have any objective way of assessing that. It's not like there's a strangeness scale that I could measure them with. The one that strikes people or gets a lot of attention as an unusual charismatic gift. Now, there are various charismatic gifts that are not unusual. These are gifts that the Holy Spirit gives to Christians to enable them to serve the body of Christ in the church. And according to St. Paul, and you know, everyone has at least one gift. You're not limited to one, but he encourages people to pray for additional gifts. But a lot of them are not particularly strange. Like one of them is teaching.
Yeah.
And I would assume whatever else is true about my spiritual life that I have the gift of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I teach in other contexts, so I think there's a natural talent there. You know, I teach things other than religion. I teach parapsychology. I teach dance. I teach in a variety mm-hmm. of contexts. And then as a Christian, God's taken that and elevated it in and uses it to build his kingdom when I teach God's word and teach about God. But that's not particularly flashy. The one gift, there are others that are. Healing,
yeah.
For example.
Right.
Prophecy is mm-hmm. another. And then there's the one that tends to get the most attention and has since the first century, which is speaking in tongues. And so even though I don't have an objective scale, and even though none of the lists of spiritual gifts are exhaustive, and God can continue to give new ones that he didn't give in the first century, I would say that at least among the ones listed in the New Testament, the one that tends to attract the most attention could be judged the strangest, and that would be speaking in tongues. In terms of how much evidence is there for extraordinary charismatic gifts, and here Julian is drawing a distinction between the ones that seem strange, like healing, prophecy, speaking in tongues, and the ones that seem ordinary, like teaching and helping others and administration and things like that. Of the extraordinary ones, how much evidence is there for them occurring today? I would say there are many reports today of extraordinary manifestations of the Holy Spirit. This has varied over time. There has not been any age of church history where there were no reports, but there was a notable uptick beginning in the late 20th century with the rise of the charismatic movement in the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and that generated a lot more reports. But they've been there all the way through church history. Another factor that tends to pertain to this area is how many have been confirmed. And I can hear the music, so I'll finish on the other side of the break.
We will take that break. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Why do we baptize? Does it really do anything? In Baptism Now Saves You, Dr. Carla Broussard explains the unbreakable relationship between baptism and salvation, making sense of the church's teaching in a way that's easy to understand and ready to share. St. Peter said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you." Discover what that means today. Order your copy of Baptism Now Saves You at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
The world has a lot of questions about Catholicism. It's a big faith, and it deserves a big book of answers. Well, now it has two. Get the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, and have 300 clear, reliable Catholic answers right at your fingertips whenever something comes up at work, with friends, or around the dinner table. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
From the dawn of creation, angels have stood in the presence of God as messengers, warriors, and guardians. Some seek our fall. Some intercede for our salvation, and one is assigned to protect you. In the new book, Angelic Answers, Father Mike Driscoll uncovers the truth about angels and their unseen battles. So mysterious to us, and yet so close. Get Angelic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Who was Jesus? It's the most important question in the world. Was he a great teacher? A religious myth? The Messiah and Lord? In Evidence for Christ, apologist Jimmy Akin builds a powerful step-by-step case from history, scripture, and reason, showing that Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy and the risen Lord. Get your copy of Jimmy Akin's Evidence for Christ today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin here. Lots of weird questions. And this one's weird, you know, because we don't usually talk about these things, but I think it's pretty... I think a lot of people would be very interested in this one who maybe might not be interested in weird, but interested in the church. How much evidence is there for extraordinary charismatic gifts nowadays? And which is the strangest? And you were in the midst of
that. Yeah, so we've already dealt with some of that. But I would say that there are, and this is true of every age, but it's especially true now with the Catholic charismatic movement. There are a lot of reports of extraordinary charismatic gifts, and there are few confirmations that something genuinely supernatural is happening. Now, I don't say that to dismiss such claims. That's always been true. That's why I put the charismatic movement in part of a broader context. There, in every age of the church, there have been a notable number of extraordinary, miraculous claims made, and in every age, most of them are not evaluated.
Right.
So there is not confirmation on many of them. So when you're asking about the evidence for today, well, we have a lot of claims, a lot of reports, but very few of those reports have been investigated. And so we can't say from an evidential perspective one way or another whether they're which ones are genuinely miraculous and which aren't. So I would say this is a matter on which people may have suspicions and intuitions about where the correct answer lies that will differ from each other. But evidentially, I don't think we can say with confidence anything in this area because the needed investigations have not been done. One way that would be, or one thing that would be interesting to investigate, are reported healings. Healings are something the church already has ways of investigating. It's not commonly done in an ordinary parish setting, like after a charismatic healing service or something, but it could be. Prophecy and can also be done. So can speaking in tongues. Especially if speaking in tongues is understood as genuine xenoglossy or speaking an actual foreign language. All of those can be investigated, but it requires resources to investigate them. And thus far, there hadn't been a pressing need to, unless something is coming along, like the person is making claims and prophetic claims and they're upsetting the parish and they need to be investigated for that reason, or the person is claiming to be a healer and they have no abilities and it's upsetting people, or maybe someone does report a healing and it needs to be linked to a saint's intercession for canonization purposes, that might get investigated. But beyond those hand-selected instances, there's not a lot of investigation that gets done for lack of resources.
Sure. Julian, thank you. Thank you for a great weird question. This one comes from S. Medrano. Is surgery...
S. Medrano, 1964, to you.
Yes, okay, you're right. That is the full name there. And I think S. Medrano and I might share something in common then, because 1964 was an important year for me.
Uh-huh.
Having come onto the earth that year.
Well, wait a minute. So there's two different things that could be involved here.
Yes.
What month were you born in?
June.
Okay. So you could have existed in 1963.
Right. I certainly did exist in 1963.
In fact, if you came in June, which is the seventh month, and you had a 9-month pregnancy, you would have been conceived in November, which is the month, 1963, which is the month John F. Kennedy was assassinated. So I want to know, did you have anything to do with it?
I had nothing. I think maybe I'm the reincarnation. I don't know. I'll just throw that out there. I don't know.
Actually, there is a famous case of, now in parapsychology, these are called FPLs, for famous past lives.
Oh, yes.
And, there are they're viewed very skeptically by parapsychologists. Anyone who claims to have been a famous person, they're going to get extra scrutiny on their case, because so many people claim it in ways that are not plausible. But there was a famous case of a man in Turkey who dreamed that – so he had an announcing dream. He dreamed that John F. Kennedy came to him after the assassination and asked to be reborn as his son. And so he named the Turkish man named his son Kennedy, K-E-N-N-E-D-I, is the way it's normally transliterated into English.
Yeah.
But young little Kennedy had no memories of John F. Kennedy, and this is not regarded as one of the more plausible cases.
Well, I can tell you, he's not the reincarnation of John.
Okay.
I have not.
I would assume the same thing. I'd say you're right on that point.
All right. So S. Medrano, 1964, says, is surgery for non-medical reasons on the human body considered mutilation? If done just for cosmetic reasons, for example, breast implants.
Okay. So unfortunately, the church doesn't have like a standard dictionary that you can go to get definitions for terms. There are individual passages in magisterial documents where terms get defined. But what S. Medrano is asking is, so first question, is surgery for non-medical reasons on the human body considered mutilation? I would say no. I would say there are surgeries that are not strictly done for medical reasons that wouldn't be mutilation. Like if a woman gets her ears pierced.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, right. That's a surgery. It's body modification. It's not for medical reasons, but it's not mutilation either. We don't see a woman with pierced ear earrings and say, oh, this person's so mutilated, you know. The way that that I would define mutilation is it needs to involve something that interferes with bodily function.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if I had my arm amputated for no medical reason, that would be mutilation. But if someone has their ears pierced or gets a tattoo or has some other kind of body modification, it's not going to be mutilation unless it interferes with body function. And it can interfere with body function and not be mutilation if it serves some legitimate purpose. Like suppose my left arm, suppose I had bone cancer.
Yeah.
All the way through it, and the only way to save my life is take that arm off. Well, okay, that's a medical reason. It's not mutilation to remove my arm. So I would say that mutilation has to be unjustified, and it has to interfere with proper bodily function in order for something to be mutilation. S. Medrano then gives an example of something done for cosmetic reasons like breast implants.
Yeah.
Well, even here, we want to be careful because some women may have breast implants for reasons that are not purely what you'd think of as cosmetic.
Uh-huh.
People think about breast enlargement as a cosmetic change, and it can be, but it can also be other things. In fact, there's also the reverse of breast enlargement, which is breast reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that needs to be done for medical reasons because you may have a really small woman and her breasts may have grown to such a size that it becomes impractical and she may need it done in order to live a normal life. And the same thing, similar things can be true. Let's say a woman had to have a mastectomy.
Right.
She might then want to replace that so she doesn't look different than the way she did before, so people don't know about her mastectomy, or lumpectomy or whatever it was. And it may help her feel better. It may have a psychological benefit, which is or is not going to be classified as a medical benefit, depending on whether you're including mental benefits alongside physical benefits. But I would say having improvements in how you feel about yourself, that's a legitimate thing. You know, it's like people who lose weight or people who gain muscle. Those are body alterations that make people feel better about themselves, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be strictly necessary for someone to lose weight or gain muscle in order for it to be justified. It can just be, I want to look thinner or I want to look more muscular or whatever. And so by extension, I don't judge people harshly if they say, I'm gonna wear different color contact lenses, or I'm gonna dye my hair, or I'm gonna get a tattoo, or I'm gonna have breast enlargement or breast reduction,
a facelift.
It's like these don't all have to have strict medical necessity in order to be justified. Simply the psychological benefits of them can justify them. And so I don't rush to classify things as mutilation. It needs to be unjustified, including in the senses I just named, and it needs to in some way materially interfere with bodily function for something to be classed as mutilation.
And I don't know if you mentioned this, but breast implants don't interfere with bodily function. Did you mention
that? I was going to mention, I mean, people think of like breastfeeding a child. Actually, breast implants don't, you know, interfere with that. They can be done in ways you can still breastfeed after breast implants have been added.
Esmedrano, thank you very much. Wonderful question. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Alexian Brothers is a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. For 800 years, these Catholic brothers have offered a prophetic and daring response to the gospel. Serving Christ in the sick, the poor, and the dying. Is God calling you to be a courageous disciple? If you feel called to total self-giving as a religious brother in the mission of Jesus, call our vocations office at 847-264-8703. That's 847-264-8703. AlexianBrothers.org.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
First of all, I would like to say that I'm so appreciative of EWTN. It has been a great help to me with respect to my Catholic faith, and I really rely on the great programs that EWTN offers us each and every day.
Well, just thank you to EWTN. I was a fallen away Catholic, and listened to EWTN and brought me back, so thank you so much.
I just feel like dancing when I hear that music. Doing a little chair dancing. Jimmy Akin, our guest.
There are such things. There's
chair dancing.
Sit dances.
Yeah.
And
that's
and
my preferred method. I prefer to do everything sitting.
they are used. I've seen, you know, private dance parties where, and video of private dance parties where a caller will do a sit dance for attendees who may not be able to get up and do. And so they'll fold the sit dances into the mix so everybody gets to participate, even if they're not physically able to get up and do a normal dance.
Well, I spontaneously do it when I hear the music for Jimmy.
Suspect you can do a normal stand dance. It's just you're tethered to the machine by your headphones and need to be near the microphone.
Yes. Although I have to admit, I am one of those people who tries to walk out of the studio with the headphones on somewhat regularly. And I don't know if we've ever
better
had to
than driving
replace
off
equipment.
With a gas pump.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I have not done that.
Are built to detach because people do forget, and you know, they go just into the store and they come back out and they get
drive
in the car
away.
And drive away, and so they're actually built to detach safely without spilling gas all over everywhere.
Yeah, that's what modern society we need to take into consideration human failings. I know I'll do it sometime, but as to this point, I have not.
Well, and it used to be a lot more common than it is now because you couldn't pay at the pump.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And now, like where I'm from, before pay at the pump, people would trust you. You know, and you know, small town in the Ozarks, people tend to know you anyway. Yeah. But you could go up and go to the pump, fill it up,
and go in and
go in and pay.
Yeah.
First time I came out to San Diego when I was doing a job interview for Catholic Answers, I went to a pump and I picked it up and I'm trying to use it and trying to use it and use it and it's not working. I finally go to the attendant and say, I can't fill up on this pump. And he explained, you're in the big city now.
It was very helpful. Yeah. You gave you a little education there. Yeah.
But, you know, I actually thought of pay at the pump when I was growing up because they had gas pumps and then they introduced ATMs when I was growing up, and I thought you could combine those.
That's
and
the,
they later did.
The Jimmy Akin mind. Now, do you remember as a child you not pumping the gas? There was an attendant that pumped the gas,
oh,
or did you
no,
not have
not
that?
No, not in Arkansas.
Oh.
There are some places where you still can't. Like
New Jersey.
New Jersey yeah. is famous for that. It used to be much more common than it is now. The 1970s and the oil shock.
But, yeah, they were the saving money any way they could.
Any way they could. And yeah. so in most of the country, except where the whatever union has a lock on things, most yeah. people pump their own gas now.
All right, back to weird questions. This one comes from Titus Constantine. Titus Constantine wants to know this. What would happen if a validly ordained Catholic priest went back in time to before the birth of Jesus and said a Mass and transubstantiated the Eucharist before Jesus instituted the sacrament? What if he went back in time to when Jesus was alive, but before he instituted the Eucharist? Would Jesus know that this time-traveling priest was turning bread and wine into his body and blood?
So there are several different ways of taking this question. The first question, now, the way that this is phrased, formally speaking, we've got three questions here. The first one is, what would happen if a validly ordained Catholic priest went back in time to before the birth of Jesus and said Mass and transubstantiated the Eucharist before Jesus instituted that sacrament? Well, if that's what he did, then that's what he did, you know, and there's not much more to say. But I suspect Titus Constantine may be wondering if he tried to say Mass and tried to transubstantiate, what would happen? And the answer is, we don't know, because God hadn't told us. The argument for he would simulate the sacrament, meaning he was trying to do it, but it didn't really happen. There was no transubstantiation. The argument would be that, well, Jesus hasn't instituted this sacrament yet, so there needs to be some kind of power flowing from Jesus to the priest to do it,
and
given when the priest has arrived in history, that power is not flowing to him yet. So it's like he's ordained, he's configured so he could transubstantiate, but the power is not flowing at this period in history to make it really happen. So that's a possible answer. I can't rule that out, but it's not my suspicion, because the thing that tends to attract attention as what does the empowering when it comes to the sacrament, if you had to pick one moment in Jesus's life, what would you guess, Sykelet, is the moment that empowers the grace that we receive in the sacraments? Is it when Jesus first stubbed his toe?
If I had to guess, I would say his death on the cross.
Yeah, okay. So it's his death on the cross or his resurrection or something in that complex of events
right.
that provides the grace for the sacraments would be what you would think. And that then raises, if that's true, then that raises the question, well, could you do the Eucharist at all before his death and resurrection? So could you?
Jesus could.
Jesus did.
Yeah.
Because he at the Last Supper.
Right, yeah.
And that's before his death and resurrection. So we can already show an instance of, even though the power is being generated at one moment in time, we can show that that the Eucharist was validly performed at an earlier moment in time.
Right.
And Jesus' birth doesn't seem to be as directly related as Jesus' death and resurrection
right.
to the sacrament. So I would say, even if the priest went back before Jesus' birth, if he's properly configured via ordination, my suspicion would be he could do the transubstantiation even if he's at a point in time before Jesus' birth. And this is relevant in light of a discussion we had last hour, because there is no absolute time and space. And therefore, you have to pick your frame of reference. And for some observers, what we would call before Jesus's birth is actually not only before his birth, not only after his birth, but after his death and resurrection.
Yes.
So I would say once the grace providing moment is anchored in space-time, it's going to apply to all of space-time. Just like people before Jesus could be saved through the death of Jesus that wouldn't occur till thousands of years later.
Right.
I would say my opinion would be the same thing's likely going to be true of the sacraments, including transubstantiation. So that would be my answer to the first two questions. The second question is, what if we went back to between Jesus's birth and his death? And when he instituted it, I'd say the same thing would apply. Then Titus Constantine's third question, would Jesus know that this time-traveling priest was turning bread and wine into his body and blood? Obviously, yes, in his divine intellect, because his divine intellect is omniscient. With respect to his human intellect, it's going to depend on your theory of his human intellect. There have been thinkers like Thomas Aquinas who proposed that even though he didn't have technical omniscience and know everything about every possible world, he had what you could call a practical omniscience in that he knew in his human intellect everything about the actual world. And if that was the case, if Aquinas was right on that, then yes, Jesus would know this priest had gone back in time and was turning bread and wine into his body and blood before he was born. But the magisterium has shied away from that view. And if you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it endorses the view that Christ's human intellect only contained extra material that he had been sent to reveal. So when he says, like, I don't know when the temple's going to be destroyed, it's because he doesn't have that information in his human intellect. He wasn't sent to reveal that.
Yeah.
Christ does not seem to have been sent to reveal that this priest was doing these transubstantiations. And so I would say that in his divine intellect, he would know the priest was doing it, but in his human intellect, he would probably not know because he wasn't sent to reveal that. It wasn't relevant to his mission.
Titus Constantine, thank you. You want to try Dog Fight 2018?
I'll do the best I can with it.
All right, Dog Fight 2018 says this: I've seen some robotics and computing developments online where scientists are already using human brain neurons and cells to run computers and robots. Mm-hmm. I've discovered a similar already existing idea in science fiction called head cheese, if you're familiar with that. I'm wondering about the ethics of this and what a Catholic should make of it. I also wonder if creating new human neurons or keeping an existing person's brain cells alive to run a computer would impede from them crossing over to the afterlife or not. Thank you.
Okay. I'm just checking this. Before I use the term, I just want to verify. Yep. I had the right term. Just wanted to check. So the concept is not called head cheese in, it is in the science fiction you're talking about, but the idea of living robots are commonly called xenobots.
Okay.
And they can involve neurons and they can be used to do computations. I would say it is not in principle wrong to use human cells for the... number one, the technology is not wrong in principle. Number two, it's not wrong in principle to use human brain cells for this because an individual cell is not a person.
Yeah.
Just like an individual blood cell of mine is not a person. So you can extract a blood cell and use it to do various things, including test it, in a way that you couldn't if it were a whole person. So if you wanted to take a single neuron out of my head and use it for some purpose, as long as the purpose is legitimate, it's not wrong to use a single neuron. You're not abusing a person. If you're starting to use enough of a person's brain cells that they develop an autonomous living human consciousness, then it's going to become the subject of rights, and that's going to have ethical implications. And if you use enough and you keep my brain in a jar, it would impede me from crossing over into the afterlife.
Don't do that, dogfight, if that's what you were planning. But thank you for the question. Jimmy Akin, I really enjoyed the propinquity. Thanks for being here in the studio with us for 2 hours.
Yeah, since we can do it for real, Wonder Twin powers,
unite.
Activate.
Oh, I thought it was unite. Sorry,
activate.
I failed.
Gotta watch more Saturday morning cartoons.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.